Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of season two of Dickinson Forevermore podcast. I am one third of your podcast host, Robin Detman. I'm a director and producer at LDW Films, and I'm the producer nerd on this podcast.
Hi, I'm Jess. I am a writer, actor, and the resident editing nerd of this podcast.
Hi, I'm Jay Red. I'm a photographer, I'm a music producer, and like my queen, Emily Dickinson, says, I dwell in possibilities.
And in this week's episode of the podcast, we're starting our season three with the Dickinson season three rewatch of episode one, Hope is a Thing with Feathers, and episode two, It Feels a Shame to Be Alive.
All right. So we are starting off, you guys, with season three, episode one. Correct. We're going to dive deep into Hope is the Thing with Feathers. Hope, people. Hope.
I have a question really quick.
Go ahead.
Sorry. Why is it in quotes? I just realized that this last time as I was writing down the title, it's like, Hope is the Thing with... And I was like, wait. And
yeah.
Maybe that's a...
Because it's the focal point of the episode. I feel that...
Poem it has quotes. That's what I don't understand. Why is it like... And I know
because
that nowadays
it's a state of mind. Hope is a state of mind and not everyone has it. So it's a hypothetical, like I'm saying that I believe in hope.
Okay.
Or you don't think you have it, but it's there. It literally says it in the poem.
No. Okay, but the reason it has quotes is because it's a hypothetical. I'm talking technically why it has quotes. Okay. I'm just asking.
I don't know. Has quotes because it's hypothetical that she's both the writer and reader in this poem. Like she's both observant but also creative.
Okay.
So I
have the worst grammar skills in the world and with punctuation and everything, so I literally had no idea. So I'm just like seriously asking, like I just noticed it and I was like, I wonder why it's in quotes. So
that makes sense. To any of our English teacher listeners, if you want to chime in on this, please feel free. Exactly. Yeah, okay. give us a tweet. So Hope is the Thing with Feathers, right? For me, hope, you know, it can mean a plethora of things, right? And I feel like during, you know, times of great suffering and pain, that is when some of the most beautiful and amazing art is made, right? Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like Fleetwood Mac. I'm thinking, you know, this pandemic that we went through, some of our, you know, our greatest artists came out with some of their best work. What do you guys feel whenever you are, let's say, in a rut or going through something? Do you feel like your artistic nature is heightened? Like, do you feel like there's like, do you feel hope? Do you, or are you inspired whenever you're suffering or going through stuff? Do you feel like it heightens your creativity?
I mean, for me, absolutely. Absolutely. But also with that said, it's kind of a double-edged blade because I'm also somebody that can still access that space while nothing is happening, while I'm completely just dormant for the most part. And I will get inspired by sometimes literal things, sometimes metaphorical things. Sometimes I'm just thinking of an idea that has nothing to do with anything in particular and I run away with it. So for me, it's, yeah, I definitely have hope. I mean, what else would we have to turn to?
What's interesting, Jay, is when you ask that question, I know a lot of artists that have to access their art through high emotion and especially pain. And I kind of feel like the reason why a lot of us do that is because our hearts are open in one way or another. So that may or may not be true, but that's what came to my mind. So it made me think like, I like Jess, I can access art at any time that's inside of me or this channel. And it's inspired by a lot of different things. It could be a moment that I want to capture, mostly in like narrative writing and stuff like that. It's about something, some sort of moment and capturing that, or some sort of human experience and capturing that. If I'm really struggling, I think my heart, if I'm super struggling, I think until my heart opens up, it kind of closes down a little bit because it protects itself and I don't access it. It's not, it's just not the same. I go into problem solving mode, which is usually.
Do you access it later on though? Like whenever you go through it and then at the end of like your suffering or your pain, do you access your creativity? Do you feel like this burst of creative energy after the fact?
You know, maybe. I don't know if there's a pattern to it. It's really kind of when my heart is open and when I'm open to like this channel, right? When I create stuff, because the things that I create are all narrative and they're stories. And so storytelling comes to me in a lot of different ways. So I don't know if there's a correlation between that. I don't feel at all that I need to go through a great painful experience or a great, there doesn't have to be any event or anything like that. But I'm sure maybe that pattern does occur when my heart opens back up and I'm ready to go through that channel again.
You said something a little while ago about whenever artists, you know, are going through stuff. And then like, I mentioned this a little bit in the last episode we did, where I was talking about great performances or like painful mm-hmm. performances that we see actors, actresses do. We've seen some of the most impactful, you know, performances from Hailee Steinfeld this season. And I kind of start to think, you know, you drop into that moment, like kind of from an analytical standpoint, what are they reaching for? Like for them to give such a beautiful, visceral performance, they have to be reaching for something, or some people just don't, right? Some people it's just in them. So like, that's kind of where I'm posing this question. Like, you know, do we even realize, you know, when we're going through all this pain and then we're creating something beautiful, do we realize it's hope? Like, are we conscious of the fact that that is what we're feeling in the moment?
Like grabbing onto a piece of light or something, grabbing onto something.
Yes. Like, I mean, healing. Sometimes. Like,
yeah, mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Because sometimes we do it just like for me, if I'm going through something, I'll immediately turn like to any piece of music or to something. Like for me recently, I mean, I was struggling back and forth. And then Coast came out by Hailee Steinfeld. Go stream it right now, you guys. And I felt like there was just like this little beam of light just kind of come through and turn everything around. Like I had already, you know, there had already been a moment where I was already kind of turning the boat around and kind of feeling a little bit better about things. And then that song came out and it was music. Y'all know I, you know, connect a lot with music, and it's I wouldn't say it's my first love, because I definitely think visual or photography or anything, like me seeing like a beautiful sunset or like beautiful landscape, that is my, you know, my main love.
Yeah.
But music is something that is so personal, so special. And I didn't even realize that that's what had happened until that song dropped. But I feel like, do we as artists, do we feel that? Do we know that that's what that is when we're going through it, or when we are like as inspired or as enlightened as we can be?
I think unless you're a person that's extremely hyper aware, I don't think so. I think it's subconscious until it becomes conscious when you create it, when you breathe life into it.
So that brings me to my next, not question, but I would say topic of discussion. All these things are happening around Emily Dickinson. You know, obviously the world is falling into chaos and everything around her is so dark. It's when she sees that CGI bird, that lovely, not so lovely CGI bird.
Hey.
So she's like, oh, hope, you know, it's, do we need symbols? Do we need a sign? Do we need?
I totally. So as far as for me getting signs from other people's art, absolutely. And it can hit at any moment, even if I'm not in a low moment. Like I, you know, there's a moment in Captain Marvel where it's like, she's about to break free and, she, there's this montage where she keeps standing up. Like, no matter what happens to her, she keeps standing up, and it's the same stance, like she's a little girl. And I was like, yes. And I still reference that. There was something, and it's always superhero movies, I swear to God. There was like when Wonder Woman was coming out of the trenches, and it was the first time we've seen a superhero woman who's like, I'm gonna fucking take on the German army. And I was like, I get goosebumps. I remember being in the theater and being like, yes, because we've been denied that for so long. And those kind of moments, hells yeah. Like, I still, if I need to get pumped up before a meeting, like, I will watch those, right? Or if I'm just pumping myself up lately of like, you know, going through the things with our kid and like, you know, figuring out hard situations and being like, you could do this, Robin. So yeah, all that to say, for me, absolutely. A lot of times it's storytelling, but it can also be a song. You know, there's songs that I have for things that I need that are like, yes. So
I will say, and this is kind of like a shout out to some of the most amazing people we've had on this podcast. Going back to Danny, and you can, I think what her Instagram handle is Poems and Petunias.
Yes.
You can go find her poetry there. Just having her on the podcast and feeling her light and her energy was also very pivotal in that boat turning around for me. And also a dear Twitter friend that we've made as well on this podcast, Courtney, just her being a master of all art, right?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And just like, she might not even realize, but she's such a light, you know?
Yeah.
She's such a light to everyone around her. And it's through her art when she posts like a new, you know, design or just something new.
Yeah.
It's always nice to see because it's just something that like, I love seeing creative people mm-hmm. really owning their space.
Mm. Yeah.
And that is something that can be so beautiful and people might not realize the impact they have, but that is basically my CGI bird is seeing the people that we've met throughout the podcast just shining in their own light in their own way and radiating everyone else's life around them.
Oh my gosh, Jay, that is so beautiful. Oh my God.
It is. Yes. And also, yes. Like, can we talk about how some of them have like collaborated or gotten together for projects as well? Right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so hold on. Shout out to Anna. Hold on.
Yeah. Shout out to Anna and
Anna. Yes. Well, okay. Right. You guys won't understand. You guys don't understand how much I adore these people. Anna, especially. She's going through this beautiful journey of what I feel like is rediscovery of herself, of her craft. I mean, obviously, we all go through things, you know, like I struggle a lot with my own self-esteem or my personal like outlook on myself, but these people are people that like bring light to us.
Yeah.
And I've seen their work and I've seen them flourish and I've seen them grow in ways. Anna's photography just keeps getting way like just better. I didn't think it was possible because she's just so incredible as a photographer.
Yeah.
I admire her so much, and Lord Jesus, I wish I had her eyes, honestly. I wish I could see through the scope of a lens the way she sees. She is absolutely incredible.
My gosh. You just reminded me of, yeah, so much amazing art and passion. And, you know, there's so much love in this work too. And that's what makes it, I don't know, that's what kind of makes it stand out. I remember Tony's edits. And
Tony was so incredible. She would just capture the emotion of the show or the episode we had watched in the moment and would capture it so vividly.
That one that she did that's no dialogue, and I forget the name of the song. It gives me chills every time I see it, and it's just them looking at each other. And she did it kind of towards the end of season two. And then she added on some stuff from season three. I'll have to post it again. It is so gorgeous and just so encapsulates for me this relationship and this connection that the characters and the actresses had, that these, you know, these silent moments. What an amazingly talented and beautiful community. Thanks for reminding me of that, Jay.
I feel like I'm reminded of it every day. Like I could be having a really horrible day or a really good day, you know, and then I don't tend to be on Twitter a crazy amount of time, but for like the few minutes that I am on there, I'll, you know, go down and see people just living and thriving. They might not believe they're thriving, but in my eyes, I just think they are so bright. These people are so bright and so brilliant. And we're so grateful to have had you guys on the podcast and have met you guys and crossed paths with you guys. Thank you, Dickinson, for that. Yeah. So
that's true.
That was very eloquent, Jay. That I must say, beautiful. Like that was, it was
beautiful. That is the hope. That is the hope that you know perches on my soul.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for joining us this week. I'm like, that was so beautiful.
Thanks for joining us as we sit here and cry.
I know. Hold, please. No, that's so beautiful.
Talk about the episode. Dickinson. Let's talk about how in despair Mrs. Dickinson always is. Can we please?
Abject bottomless despair. Stop.
Oh my gosh. Yep. Episode one. She's cracking. That's like
You said she's cracking. She's cracking me up.
She's starting to crack. Like you're starting to see, right? The last episode that we saw in 9? Where she finally said something to people, she kind of like started to buck up a little bit against Edward. And it was just that one remark about like, if women, you know, there wouldn't be wars if women were in control or whatever. But I feel like you're starting to see like the cracks coming of her, like.
We're starting to see the corset unravel.
Yes, in some ways.
Well, we're really starting to see like the individuality of her. Mm. Like we always associate her with, you know, being Mrs. Dickinson, right? But not.
The housewife, yeah.
Emily Dickinson.
Yeah, yeah. She's coming out and becoming an individual and not just the perfect tea setter.
Well, I mean, I love that we're seeing this side of her because we get to see, like, yeah, I joke around a lot about how Mrs. Dickinson has always been in despair. There's always something going on with her, right? But I it's not that I love to see people suffer, but I love to see how it's all coming to life. Like all the years of her being the perfect housewife or trying to be the perfect mom, how all of that has weighed on her and how she's finally starting to feel like like this has been my life. Like, you know, or like, you know, losing her sister, that was probably one of the things that had her still holding on. Like, well,
yeah. And I also thought, this occurred to me the second watching, that like, I think she might also be responding to the fact that that Aunt Lavinia is being like tossed aside in some ways of like, the priest is like, wait, who is this? Or the minister. And it's like, because she's a woman, she doesn't matter as much as these young kids dying, young men dying. And then Mr. Dickinson goes and talks and doesn't, you know, to the family, does a little family, whatever, and doesn't mention her. I think that might be part of it too, is that she's starting to see how the world looks at her or how
she, yeah, she's world been looks feeling it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've something kind of related to that later when Sue's giving birth for the next one, but I don't know. Like, again, I feel like there was that thread there, and you know, sometimes with threads, if they're not overt, I'm like, maybe it's just my thread. Right. I mean, I don't remember going through that journey as a woman, really, you know, having to discover my worth because I was kind of raised differently, but.
Well, I mean, I feel this on a personal level in a different way because I mean, growing up in a brown household where I don't know if this is just a mom thing in general, but like I grew up in a house full of boys. I'm the only girl. I was raised the hardest. Because I am a girl, and like the boys are all, they're babied. I mean, example A, my brother living with me right now. but yeah, like it's so we're expected and we're held to a higher standard. But then again, like the world just treats us like garbage. Like we're disposable. Like
the world.
We're just a piece of property, or we're just here to one, procreate. And two, just mother everybody.
Yeah.
Like, and that is our role until we die, which is, it's so, And it's so tragic. So I like now my relationship with my mother has changed in dynamic. And I try to make it a point to let my mother feel and see her worth outside of her being a mother, outside of her just being a wife. You know, she's dedicated so many years of essentially her entire life to doing this, you know, or most of her life. So I just feel like, you know, Mrs. Dickinson is in that place, you know, no one, and no one besides, I feel like, Emily is actually there to try to like hold her mom up as a daughter does, you know?
Yeah. So I looked a little bit into history. So I have a little bit of fun facts for this period. I was kind of inspired when I was looking at the beginning where they had Sue talking and showing Emily's poetry, which again is so important to actually see the way she wrote it. So Aunt Lavinia she died of consumption. Between 1860 and 1863, which is when this season is supposed to be placed with the Civil War, Sam was still in everybody's life in real life. So this, you know, he and Emily, I don't think had a falling out until like 1862, late 1862, 1863. Mary was visiting Evergreens. So she was going to, you know, she was obviously, it was different. So as far as writing goes, guess how many poems was estimated that Emily wrote in 1861 and 1862? So 1860, she wrote about 86 poems. And again, this is all estimated. 1861,
I was going to say about 100, right?
Well, 1861 and 1862, the numbers are very close. Guess how many poems she wrote?
Less than 50.
No, more than 200.
Yeah, it was her most prolific time.
And that's where I understand that, but there is a place in time where she barely wrote at all.
I don't know. I'm referencing two books. One is Open Me Carefully, which references poetry and letter poems that were sent to Sue that were later, etc., and then talking about that. And then there's also this other book, which also has its bias in some place, but My Wars Are Laid Away in Books, and then referenced it with another one. So again, nobody really knows, right? Because there were no dates put on these things. It's like the fascicles, and then, you know, artificial dates were estimated by like Franklin, apparently. Like they don't know, and they're like, I think it was this year. It's just, they just know that she wrote more poetry during the Civil War than any other time. So.
Yeah, it was said to be her most prolific writing time, right? So that brings me full circle to my notion is like during great times of suffering, during, you know, some of our hardest times in life as artists, you know, you find a lot of inspiration and not light, but try to find light and are inspired to do what you do best is your art. And I feel like that is really where I was going with, this being, you know, we see that this season she's just, all she wants to do is write. She feels like this is her duty. This is the burden that was bestowed upon her, essentially. Yeah.
It's what she's contributing to the world as she knows it. But also, I mean, they did claim that this readers of hers and, you know, of the time and even now, they say that this period, even in the projection reel right at the beginning of the episode, they say it's a great and classic descent into a personal inferno. I would expect that statement alone to be indicative of it being a prolific era, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, yes. No, but you know what's so crazy to me is you said some words that just kind of like jumped out at me, right? You said this is what she's contributing to who, though, is the question, because she wanted her poems discarded. Essentially, well, she didn't want to share this,
Sue, though,
but around her people.
No. She was sharing them in real life. She just wasn't getting them published. She shared them with Sam,
with her
she
close
shared
circle.
Them with Higginson. She shared them with Sue.
But she tells Fraser, which we'll see and talk about later on. She tells him she writes for nobody. She wrote it for no one. The poem that she gave him, she wrote for no one. So she's essentially writing for the unknown soldier to give them hope.
Well, so here's some other facts that go along with this conversation. Facts that one of them's factual because people actually counted. So What's interesting, 21 instances of the word hurt, either used as a noun or a verb, all of them in all her poems occurred from 1860 to 1863. The only time, estimated again, because again, there's no true dating of her poems, but it's estimated that she only used the word hurt 21 times, and it was in between 1860 and 1863. I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. It's also the time when she started the master letters. Also, Sue got pregnant and had Ned and Martha. And she, Emily wrote that song, Rearrange a Wife's Affection, which is a pretty graphic poem. Talks about making me a bearded like a man. Starts switching a lot more with gender during this period as well, right? Especially again with the master poems. And then there was this one redacted poem that she sent to Sue, which I thought this is really interesting because everybody always talks about this desperation and how she had unrequited love. And there's desperation in her poems, this person who's like, I love you and you don't give me enough. But she wrote this, she wrote a poem and Sue's name was redacted on the verso of it. It was erased. And you can see it unopened carefully on page 101. And it starts off saying, the face I carry with me last when I go out of time, to take my rank by in the West, that face will be just thine. And the whole poem is more like not a desperate, why don't you love me? Why can't I have this? Why blah, blah, blah. But like this declaration of like saying to whoever it's written to, Sue, that like your face is the last face that I'm gonna see and et cetera, et cetera. So, and about a month later is when it's estimated she started writing the master poem. So I don't know. I just thought it was, those were kind of interesting facts about how fertile both Sue and Emily were during that period.
When I'm a ghost, I'm literally going to go follow Emily Dickinson with a notepad and a pencil. And then I'm going to ask her all these questions to see, yo, when did you do this? When did you write this? And then
what
I'm going to come back.
What year did you write this?
And then I'm going to come back to y'all and be like, yo, so this is what she said, y'all.
Yeah. I don't know. Again,
well, we know Robin's only question is going to be, so who was the master? We all know who
the master was. Come on. The only time she ever mentioned a master was in a letter to Sue and a poem to Sue. No other person. So at least
so
not that I found.
Emily is a bottom confirmed.
No, but and she switched. I mean, come on. I think her imagination was completely fertile. And she was like, well, somebody's off having a baby. I'm just going to fantasize about some stuff. I don't know. She talks about having a beard like yours.
I got to say is we love a non-binary queen.
Totally. Also, I love a mystery. I don't know. I have, you know, again, I have my whole narrative in my head that was built off of, I agree a lot with Martha Nell Smith and like, whatever, but like, it's kind of fun. I don't know. Anyway, I just thought I'd share those interesting tidbits.
Mm-hmm. So can we talk about the opening montage though? Like please. The battlefield montage, like my editing brain is on fire.
Yeah, you like but, that.
Oh yeah, I do. So I kind of pulled what I thought when I saw the montage, right? So like instead of just saying what I saw, I'm saying what I feel about what I saw.
Okay.
So I feel like her rifle and bayonet are her pen and inkwell. I feel like her words are both symbolic and metaphorical bullets. And Dickinson's war is waged within but reflected in battle on screen. I mean, it's indicative of what's going on in the real world around her, but also in this reverie of hers where she's trying to equate her experience with what's going on in the world and trying to relate to it on that level so that she can write about it.
Mm.
I just feel like this couldn't, like us doing this rewatch for this episode or for this season couldn't have come at a better time because we are quite literally fighting for our lives right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I feel like this show through season 1, 2, and 3 everything is just so relatable. Everything you can just put into context as to what is happening today. And yeah, especially for women.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Elena had such, like, had intention with so much of the parallels, but then also shot something 2 years earlier before something else happened. And so, like, almost in a predictive way, which is really amazing.
I feel like she was both bold and careful at the same time. Like, she did everything so methodically and so carefully and with such, what's the word I'm looking for? It, with such, you know, genius, finesse. It's something that is, she
je ne sais quoi.
I don't know. It was so pure. Like, I feel like it was so,
yeah, pure.
Like, it was that's bold, but not like wounding. It was very like, open your eyes, but in a very careful way.
Yeah, it wasn't damaging to you, but you needed to see it.
It was very educating, but in a very like motherly kind of way.
Yeah, and also totally. And also for me, it's never been didactic. It's never been preachy. It's kind of like, here's a take on it. Take it. Like, it's not easy, and it's not easy to digest, right? It's still challenging. Like, it's like invites you to go in and figure it out for yourself and to connect dots on your own, which I think, again, I've talked about the brilliance of that kind of writing and the new, you know, sometimes nuance, sometimes overt, and the balance she gets with that, where some things are in your face, but you still got to figure it out. Like, it's not spoon fed to where it's like, this is that, you know, there's nothing.
I just feel like everyone always says her writing and the show and everything was ahead of its time, or, you know, that is why it's not getting the recognition it's getting, or that it should, you know, the recognition it should get, right? Everyone's saying it's so ahead of its time, you know, these people aren't ready for it. No, the time is now. The time is now. If you're not watching this show and you're not comprehending and seeing your life or our life reflected in it, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be reflective also of the industry, of the fact that they're not ready for it. I mean, the industry is still led by cis, older, white men. And so it's like, I don't think the industry was ready for it. I mean, we've talked about this. Apple, like, people are still complaining about it when it comes to other series that they have that's really great. Their marketing team, I'm sorry, their marketing sucks. And like, it's not just Dickinson. And I hate to say that, because who am I to talk about an entire marketing department? But like, they don't market this amazing stuff that they have, because the critics love this season. The critics
I'm glad Apple gave Dickinson a lane of its own to get into, and it gave it, you know, the airtime, right? I'm glad that Elena was allowed to create this and really do what she wanted with it.
Yeah.
But I feel like we talked about media like over the last two episodes, and it's like media today is so like, you're not getting the facts anymore. You're not getting what you need to get out of it anymore. Media is such a circus now, as well as the industry. It's all just a circus, you know. There's not like, everything is so censored so that you don't get the information you need.
Yeah.
And I don't like it whenever people call this show woke or anything like that. Like, no, it's not ahead of its time. It's not, you know, woke. It is what it needs to be. And it is now. It's in the present, and we need it.
I think the word woke was used correctly by certain people 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And now it's just used by assholes to say that, you know, having a certain amount of awareness and caring about everybody and not just yourself. Like, I'm
gonna be real with you. I never liked the word. I never liked the word 4 years ago, 5 years ago. I never liked the word.
I know. I think, like, it's kind of weird, but I think it fit early on when people were waking up. People were waking up to be like, fuck, shit. You know, like, everything's not okay anymore. Like, it was just, you know, in the pan, like, it had kind of its place, but it was never used as this banner. And now people that, whatever, again, we don't want to get into politics, but it's being used as a weapon now against, you know, people that are trying to do good. So yeah, it's dumb, but yeah, Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why the reason for me, I've never liked the word, whether it was like before the pandemic or just whatever, like I've never liked the word because it's like, whenever people are like, oh yeah, I'm waking up to the idea. It's like, it's not the fact that you're waking up. It's that like, literally you're pulling the wool from over your eyes. Like, it's just like all of this stuff.
Like coming up for air. It's like you're right. Like you're in water. You're just submerged in society. Like the Matrix.
Yeah. We're just more exposed to information than we have been before. And we can attest it to people like, you know, I don't want to get too political, but AOC that has been, you know, going door to door before her, you know, elections and stuff like that, and getting people registered to vote, making sure people have the access to the information that they need, right? Just like young people or just people in general that have become more active throughout the years, trying to make sure everyone has the information they need.
Yeah.
That's also kind of why I like Twitter so much. Yeah. Is you just see so much that you just don't see anywhere else.
Yeah. Or get your take. Yeah. So yeah, all that to go back to Apple did not do Dickinson well, but I think it's going to stand the test of time. I mean, I'm really, really hoping that all my little tweets,
I mean, you see us now.
Whip entertainment. No, but like there's this huge educational, there's a huge educational market that I found when I was trying to sell, and I almost sold it, an adaptation of a Joyce Carol Oates short story. And it ended up not happening because of this agent guy. But there's a huge market out there, and it's good money. So Whip Entertainment, I don't think Apple TV is going to own the rights after. I think that's what Elena was saying, is after a year, they're not going to own the rights anymore. And then anonymous content. The market is huge. They can make a lot of money, and it could be available in every single college and university or high school. And so they'll have this alternative, not alternative, but an extra addition to the canon. And I think no matter what, I hope it lives on, because streaming does not live on forever. I mean, people, I don't know if people know that, but like once Netflix drops a show, if it hasn't been made into a DVD, that's it.
Yeah, no, and then so here's my take. Like, I mean, I definitely agree with you. It's going to stand the test of time. Like, you see us now. The show's been over for quite a minute. We're still out here doing this podcast, y'all. We're still doing it. Here's another thing. But, like, I remember telling you guys when we first started this podcast, I learned about Emily Dickinson in high school, and we only covered her a little bit. And to see now, my little brother, he's 14, in school this year, they covered in depth Emily Dickinson. So now she's getting, you know, more exposure, and she's out there, and they're appreciating her work. And also my little brother gave the podcast a shout out. He told his English teacher to listen to us. So yeah. So awesome. I mean, there we go. The exposure's all the way. And then he also told her, watch the show. She watched the show. She loves it. So I mean, yeah, no, this show is just gonna keep getting more people to watch it. It's just gonna keep living on, and Emily Dickinson is just gonna, you know, be thriving as always.
She is eternal. All right. Do we want to talk about Austin? Poor Austin, you can't put it. I'm gonna come over in my pajama. No, okay, so we all know Austin is heading straight into an existential crisis, and he's still in the little boy mode at this point. He started questioning, right, last season especially. And you've always seen these glimpses of Austin wanting to do the right thing. I think we've always seen a glimpse of him wanting. He's always, like, there's been a, you know, he was a kind of like what, a early, like late teenager when we've supposedly when we met him. So he was self-centered. He's a spoiled white kid.
Here's my question.
What?
Do we feel like he's actually going through little boy phase, or do we feel like he's finally, because here's the thing. When I go through something, I'm 26, right? I'm still growing up, right? Like, I have moments when I derail too, right? But then you come up so much like more wiser than you were before going through, you know, and blowing your life up.
I
don't know, like, the first time I watched the season, I was like, oh my god, Austin, like, oh, you couldn't be like more of a titty baby, basically. Like, you couldn't be more of a baby, right? But now I'm rewatching it and I'm like,
you're making Jess spit up. Audience can't see it. It's coming down. It's coming out of Jess's nose. No, I'm just kidding.
So listen, like, I now that I'm rewatching it, I'm like, you know what? He's so much more relatable to me now. Like, I'm like, you know what? Like, I feel like, yes, is he being, you know, chaotic as hell? Is he being a baby? Absolutely. But like, it's growing pains. It's growing pains. Yeah. I feel like you have to.
Yeah, no. There's never been a question of that. Like, honestly, of course, I mean, we all go through this, right? I mean, he's confronting, like, why he's there. He's confronting his life, right? He's lived sort of a lie for a while, and now he's like, it's not working. I think he's still in it in the beginning of this, because he's still like, what am I going to do? My friends are coming over, and you know, but he's about to start going into, you know, not being able to deal with like what's going on, really. So he's going to start drinking. He's going to start telling the truth, because he does start spouting truth. He's just not ready to do action about it. He's not changing anything. He's just.
I think that's totally relatable. Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, no. I've always related to like what he's gone through. Totally. No, I didn't grow up as privileged as him, but I mean, I have always had privilege because I'm white, but like, you know, having things done for me and then having like, you know, like women have to do things for men, you know, that's still,
I mean,
my
we
mom,
see
before
it.
She
yeah.
died was like, make your brother a sandwich. I'm like, he's 62. Why would I make him a sandwich? You know what I mean? There's still that just like you were saying, but yeah, anyway, sorry. I think he's always been relatable in that way. I mean, a lot of times, just like Emily's about to go through the inferno too, right? It's like, we got to go through hell before we can be like, a lot of times, right? Find our way and be like, take some action and then change the, you know, change things.
I feel like Emily is definitely a little bit more proactive though, because she's like really trying to challenge herself head on. Whereas I feel like Austin is kind of taking the easy way out, where he's kind of avoiding his problems and drinking, which is why I'm saying like maybe he's like a little bit more relatable to me this season, because like I usually, when I go through things, I can figure them out. I'm a pretty good problem solver. I just have to freak out first before I get there, you know.
What about you, Jess? Like, do you when you're solving something in your life, do you do what Jay and I do, which sounds like we both do the same thing, which is like, I'll react first and then I'll have a big like, oh no. And then like when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, like just bawled for like 15 minutes. And then I was like, okay. And then taking action is also my way of like, you know, when it comes to something like that, you're kind of taking control as much as you can too, because it's, you're in an uncontrolled situation. But I always react really heavy first and then I have to go into action. What about you, Jess?
Well, I feel like I kind of have a unique perspective on this because I'm a dispatcher. So action is typically first go, but I'm pretty quick to the take, I'd say. I'm more internal, but I'm quick about it.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
Do you have a reaction afterwards? Okay, I'm dispatching.
When it's all
said
and done, I will absolutely probably cry.
Okay. Well, I mean, I've been on the phone with her before. Like, I've never seen her fully like ever have a meltdown. I've always ever, like, when I watch her, it's always like internal. I always see her just like the wheels are turning on the inside. Like, you're absolutely, like, when you're saying this, I'm just like, yes, queen. Like, this is you. Like,
confirmed, yeah, Jess. It has been internal. Confirmed.
Yes. Can confirm. Yes.
We can concur.
I wish I had the composure that Jess has. Like, literally, she is as cool as a cucumber when things are, you know, going wrong and they're chaotic. She just is so, like, she has the blinders on. She's so focused. She's so, you know. And then there's moments whenever I do see her like afterwards and then just kind of like have a whole meltdown, you know, as a Sag does, you know, but like, it's not more of a meltdown. It's more of a, I'll burn stuff down.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, see. Yeah. So I might be a little classic Sagittarius.
Oh, here it comes. Gotcha.
But
well, yeah, I can do that.
Internal. My freak outs are after.
I'm good in a crisis. I can hold my stuff and then wait. Like if I need to be, you know what I mean? In the big stuff, like if there's like kid something or something huge, I can hold my shit together. And then when everything's
I'm gonna be real with y'all. Whenever I'm going through shit, I just kind of like am doing the shit, but I am freaking out simultaneously. Like I'm a multitasker. I will scream while I'm getting shit done. Okay, like Jess saw me earlier. I had just got back from like being out, and then literally like I was like, oh my God, I'm not ready. And then I was screaming as I was getting everything ready, you guys. Yeah. Like that is literally like, I'll get it done, but I'm going to freak out while I'm doing it.
Screamer and a doer. All right. So then we have Austin. So bring it back to Dickinson again. So then we have Austin, who's, I don't know, in my opinion, starting his own inferno, and then his truth inferno for everybody. Cause that's one thing, is that he's, by bringing it out there, even though he's drunk at the time, whatever, he's putting it in people's face. And so they're going to have to start dealing with it in a new way.
I mean, they always say babies and kids and drunks always tell the truth.
Well, yeah. Yeah. I think, yeah. So what about Conky? Like... Do you guys want to talk about Conky and the whole proposal?
No, I just want to pretend it never happened.
I love that. I love to see these two episodes, the comedy, the timing. I feel like Haley like was in her like amazing element for that. And I feel like, you know, seeing what she brought, seeing Haley and Ella, their chemistry, but then also the way comedy, they're bouncing off each other. And then Jane's in there. Like, I feel like both these episodes are just like some of my favorite comedic stuff ever in the show.
Just real quick, were you about to say something, Jess? Because I feel like you were about to say something.
I was, because I was the only one that did not put my take in about what Austin's going through.
Yes, but please.
Everybody knows what I'm the resident apologist for Austin. So
it's okay. I took his side now.
Like, I'm pretty sure anybody that listens to this is going to be like, okay, this bitch is going on and on about Austin for 3 seasons. I've been protecting him.
Someone has to do it.
Wait, you know, I again have a problem with the word apologist. It's understanding a character and having a take on that is not an apology. I feel like apologist is like not giving characters their due.
Well, I mean that my takes are on him, on what he's going through, are usually apologetic in nature, is what I mean. Like, I'm defending him a lot of the time. So I feel like that makes me an apologist for him.
I'm an Emily Dickinson is not a bottom apologist. So like,
you are living in the same weird world that Austin's living in, because it's so obvious.
Let me live.
Confirmed it. Everybody,
anyway. You just don't want to see me. Let me thrive, okay? Like, let me have my moment.
Listen,
okay,
I will.
Anyways,
you...
yes, Jess. I mean, please tell me what you thought about Austin.
Nope.
Being a titty baby
again.
I'm just kidding. I was having his back the whole time too.
Okay. Well, I will say that I feel like he's absolutely speaking his truth and he's unapologetic about it. And because of that is why everybody has like such this disdain for him in the moment, because he's saying what other people are thinking, but nobody has the guts to say out loud because they're all trying to be so stoic, as the Dickinsons like to be, right?
I don't know if it's stoic.
I don't know if I agree with that.
I think it's like... I don't know if it's stoic. I will say, I don't know if it's stoic. I think they're just going on with life as it is. Like I don't think they had much of a choice back then.
Mean by that is multiple references they've made throughout the show about Dickinson's being such quiet and reserved people to the open public, right? People know them to be as quiet and reserved. They think the siblings are nuts, right? But they generally think the Dickinsons are quiet people, novels and chill.
Well,
okay, just to take you back to an episode. Okay, well, anyway, so I feel like he's saying what other people are actually thinking, but won't say out loud. But I will say that I really like this turn of events with him and Jane, in the sense that she's giving that same truth back out to him.
Yeah.
Like, she reciprocates that truth every time he spits it out.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I feel like he's figuring out who he is now that he's no longer going to associate himself, at least at this time, with his father. Right.
He has
to deal with his father. And I feel like because of that, you know, people are seeing Austin falling apart. Naturally, he's devolving, but I feel like he's also figuring himself out, learning who he is outside of the Dickinson dynamic, like who he is as an individual.
Yeah. Well, yeah, totally. I do have to say, I don't agree that the family has the awareness yet of how Edward represents the time and the patriarchy and holding them all in a cage. I don't think Emily hasn't discovered it yet. She's bucked up against it, but until the last scene is, I think, when she really realizes it. I think Sue's been seeing it, and Lavinia's starting to wake up to it. So I don't think everybody's been thinking. I disagree that everybody knows this, acknowledges it, and won't say it. I think they're all starting to wake up, and he's the first thing of him saying it out loud where they have to all start dealing with it. That's kind of my take on it.
Well, here's a question I feel is important. Do you think that because it came from Austin is why it left such an indelible mark on them, right? Like, they, if they're all just waking up to this ideology, right, that Austin has about his father, then do you think it would be different had it come from, say, Mrs. Dickinson, or if one of the ladies would have stood up and kind of said what Austin said? I think it would have been completely dismissed. I think they would have discussed it, like, internally, but I think that Austin, as a man also of the Dickinson family, I feel like them witnessing him falling apart and also him speaking truth is what's waking them up. But Emily's devolving herself.
I think it might be part of it.
I'm gonna be real with you. I think even now they're not taking him seriously.
Yeah.
There's a part of me that just sees, like, yeah, maybe, like, he's the first one to, like, snap awake, right? But, like, I also feel like, oh, he's just, you know, he's just going through
it. He's drunk.
Like,
Yeah. Like, I think it's an important part of it, though, because I think if someone says something, he could be dismissed because he's drunk and he's kind of whining, or he's, like, not, it's, like.
So I feel like what did it was him pulling himself out of the equation. I think that's what really started to shake things up for them. Like, when he stopped messing with the family and he was like, I'm seceding completely, and, like, just pulling himself out of the situation, that's when they started to, like, react, like, oh, he's really not messing with us right now. Oh, what is going on? Oh, the family's falling apart. That's when I feel like they started reacting a little bit.
Well, I agree. And then I also think you see, Lavinia's already started to react to the fact that young men are dying, and that, like, Joseph Lyman died, which is true, because the real Joseph Lyman did die in the war. And, like, and that was, like, they did have whatever they had in real life. So I think they're already starting, just like we saw Mrs. Dickinson, they're already starting to question their place. And so I think Austin, it's very, like, I think it's triggering them to have to look at everything. Emily has to look at things. Right? Because she's been in this power thing with her dad, but she's had her own power there. And, like, they've had this relationship, but she has to start really looking at things now, because Austin's pulling away from the family and she's freaking out about that. And then Lavinia is like, what the hell? Like, I'm not going to have anybody left to marry, which is, like, the very beginning sort of part of, like, who am I? And we see her journey. So I think it was part of the catalyst. I don't think it was the whole catalyst, though. you know. I mean, Sue's seen it because she's been out of it. I think she's always seen it because she's been slightly removed from it. You know, she didn't grow up in that family, and so she's not beholding to Mr. Dickinson the way that all the rest of them all are. But
and she's just always had her own power, I feel like. She's always been this strong woman that has been very, like, I mean, we've seen her go through her struggles, obviously, but, like, that has always known in what direction she was going and what she wanted in life.
Sue?
Yes.
Yeah, I think as soon as she started to get more control over her life, you know, again, like last season, she did what she did. But, like, she was also like, I want this painting. I want this thing, for right or for wrong. And then now you see her really, you know, you start to see her wanting to build the life that she wants now, and talking about it and telling Emily over and over again that she loves him, and then being just really honest about, like, I don't need Austin, and, you know, this isn't a marriage now. I wish we, you know, starting to talk about that.
Well, I mean, even then, I feel like even like real life Sue, before she was even entirely in the equation, she was this powerful woman. Like, she was someone that was captivating. She was extremely smart,
yeah,
a brilliant person, and really just held her own. But not only that, she was described to be very strikingly beautiful, but with, like, you know, she wasn't entirely feminine, but she also had, like, you know, dominant features that were very, like, you know, had obviously both Dickinson siblings enamored. But yeah, she was able to captivate people's attention and had that power of herself.
Yeah. I'm excited to watch this again, because I do really love, I love Austin's character arc throughout the whole show. And I feel like all of us in one way or another go through what he goes through and have to deal with trying to make the world the way we want it. And like, I've always related to, like, very clearly, like, you know, like the world presenting itself, or people being like, this is who I am, and I'm like, nah. They're like, nope, seriously, this is who I am, and I'm like, no, you're not, and then get slapped in the ass about it. I've always related to that with him. But anyway, I love his arc. I whenever I think about his arc, I think about where we're gonna end up, and the last beautiful shot of him. So yeah, I don't think that's what the real Austin was like. It doesn't sound like it in any way, shape, or form, but I love the show Austin, even though he pisses me off.
I do feel like even in real life, he had his moments, his shining moments.
He probably did. He just sounds like a big dick.
But I mean, I just feel like we don't focus too much on it, just because we're all so focused on real life Sue, real life Emily, and real life Emily, who is the real star of the show.
Yeah.
Which is who we should be focused on.
Anyways. I think it's the whole Mabel Todd Loomis thing, right? I mean, what happened with him once they became a couple? I mean, again, we only kind of know it through letters and through what we've seen.
I hope she's rolling and tossing and turning in her fucking grave.
The fact that he redacted, he was part of that. Anyway. So.
Love makes you do crazy things.
It does. All right. Anything else about episode one?
No, let's dig it. Well, I mean, unless Jess, you got something going on.
Wait, I have one more thing. This this doesn't make sense, but I love the fact. So we're recording this like 2 weeks after we did season two, Dickinson, episode 9 and 10, right? So the last time we saw Emily and Sue, they were having at it, right? Or they were mostly having at it, and then eating and taking a bath and stuff. But it's like, you know that, like, they consummated their love, etc. They're spiritually married. The next time you see Sue, she's pregnant. So of course it's not Emily's baby, but for some reason that made me really happy. Like, for a long time, I was like, I wish we could have seen that whole thing where they're sneaking around and they're like, oh, we're having fun in the parlor. But then this time I was like, there's something really cool about that. I don't know. Is that weird?
Emily is the father, Your Honor.
Like,
she is the father.
Somehow.
Mari said, you are the father.
You are. Anyway, I just, for some reason, that made me really happy, even though, of course, it doesn't make any sense and it's not her baby. But it's kind of feels like their relationship, not that everybody has to get married, not that everybody has to have a baby, but if you are going to do those two things,
Like, there's no coincidence she's dressed in all black, and so is Darth Vader. Luke, I am your father. Yeah.
It happened later.
I guess the only things that, like, that I know that we haven't covered yet was that quick discussion they had about the new normal, and that kind of coincides with today's times, right? Yeah. It being the new normal, us having to adapt constantly.
So a good transition from that, since we were talking about babies and the new normal and what we see as life being, right?
Yeah.
It only leads me to transition into episode 2 of season 3. It feels a shame to be alive. What a poetic way to transition, because, you know, babies being born into this crappy life situation that we call, and it's, hey, look, it's happening today, guys. Babies are being born into this.
We need them. The youth are going to save us. Not even you, even younger. They're going to save us. They're going to save us.
Look, Robin, I'm going to be real with you. I don't know about that. All right. I have little brothers that are technically Gen Z. No.
We millennials are struggling. Okay.
I'm trying. Look, we're trying our best. All right. We are trying our best. But no, I don't know about Gen Z. I'm going to be real with you. I don't know about Gen Z.
I'm talking about the next generation. I'm talking about whatever the generation thing is. I still never know where the gaps are.
Yeah, there's no letter after Z.
There's evolution. There's totally evolution. I believe in that.
Oh, good. God
knows.
So.
God knows older people aren't going to save us. So that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that part.
No, but there's too many people. Anyway.
It feels a shame to be alive, which is something that is so fitting today, as we are surrounded by all this disease and all this chaos that, I mean, even back then, they were surrounded by it. And it's just like, we feel like sometimes we're moving the needle, but it's like we're moving the needle in a circle and we're going right back to where we were. So,
well, some of us are. I have to say, and again, we're not going to get too deep into politics, but I have to say, in the last 3 days, I've seen people taking matters into their own hands, like people starting to speak up and really fight. And like, I feel like, and even in a really big way, like about the abortion thing, did you guys know that people in Georgia, that people are declaring embryos on their tax returns now? They're like, well, if it's a person, I'm going to claim it as a dependent. And that's going to trigger a lawsuit. There's like people, the lawyers have been getting in there, and it's not just that. Like, I don't know. Like, I'm starting to see this grassroots thing, and then actual people in the system, which, you know, we've had our talk about how the system is like so perverted to the, like, but I don't know. I had some ray of hope.
There was a lady in Texas that literally got pulled over for being in the HOV lane.
Yes.
And she was pregnant, and she like was like, well, it's high occupancy. Like, she's like, my fetus counts as a person, right? Because that's what y'all are arguing. And I mean, it's also like, I live in Arizona, which is, you know, it's split between super conservative people and like people that want progress, right? And I see just the amount of youth like going out and organizing.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not going to vote here. I'm going to vote in Texas, where my vote is extremely important.
Yeah.
But here I see all the youth, all the people that are like 20, that are like my age, or even like, you know, touching, you know, like older millennials, right? But they're out there organizing in numbers, trying to make sure that this state goes Democrat. Like, they go to where it's more progressive, where they could get, you know, Arizona, because surprisingly Arizona was voted the worst state to live in. But they're trying to change that. They want it to be a better place for their kids, for themselves.
Well, I think, and really, that's what's going to, I mean, I think that's what's going to save us. And then there's a lot of people who want the same things, who aren't exactly party driven at all, who want to see different things happen or more parties and like all this and the system change. And then it's like, people, what I'm happy about is people are like, okay, we have one system right now, let's blow it up.
It's it's gotta
do something, and then let's make a new system. But that whole apathy,
I'm neither Democratic nor Republican. I don't claim a party. I what I feel like I am is progressive, period. I'm just progressive. We need to move the country forward and out of the way it's been. But I feel like this title in this episode is so fitting. It feels a shame to be alive. It does. Like in the episode, I mean, we're talking about all this death, everyone, you know, around them dying, and it just feels a shame to be there, right? To how, why do they get to live and all these young men get to die? It's same situation today. Like there are people dying that don't need to die, you know, whether it be Black men, brown men, or women, because now we're being forced to carry babies and having to give birth to them regardless of our health conditions. It just feels a shame to be alive when so many people are suffering.
Yeah, I didn't know where you were going with that. And I completely agree. Because at first I was like, it's never a shame to be alive. Like, that's my first reaction. I'm like, no. Yeah.
I feel like it always does. And this is kind of weird coming out of my mouth, right? But it always feels like such a burden to live. Or to live a like better life when there are people out here suffering. And it's so hard, like seeing homeless people or seeing, you know, the system treat other people terribly, right? Yeah. Like for me, I've always felt really guilty because I'm Mexican and I was born here, but like I have a lot of friends or family members that didn't get that privilege to be there, you know, to be here and to have an easier life.
Yeah.
And it's a burden, but we are the people that are burdened to use that voice.
Yes. That's what I was going to say, was that we turn that burden into like, we use that as fuel and we use like resources that we have that others might not, to be able to like really create equity. And
I mean, I take it very personally. Like I'm not going to name any names, but I will discuss a situation that happened at work. One of the workers that works under me, there was a homeless person that came in, and obviously, I mean, they're homeless. They don't smell like flowers and daffodils. And that worker looks at me and they were like, oh my God, he reeks and this and that. And I was like, I quickly pulled them aside and I was like, that's not okay. That's not okay. They're homeless. What do you want them to smell like? I was like, how would you smell if you were homeless? I was like, show them love, show them care, give them the best customer service they've ever had, and go on about your day. I was like, do not be rude. Do not be ugly to these people that don't have a better life than you.
Yeah.
Or probably can't. Like, it's,
yeah,
you have to give a voice to the voiceless.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. It is a good point. I feel like, as you said, Jay, speaking about the guilt thing, you know, for me, a lot of the times it's when I see like homeless veterans, right?
Exactly.
And as a veteran myself, I'm just like, okay, well, I made different choices. And for a long time, I would just justify that in my own mind. Like, I made different choices. Maybe I made better ones, or maybe I made just different ones in general. And yeah, they didn't, you know, go down, I mean, that same,
maybe they path. Didn't have that opportunity. That's how I started to look at it too. Cause I'm also a veteran as well. And it hurts to see, like, every time I do see someone homeless, or every time, like, I don't know their life. I don't know what they've been through. I can't, the only thing I can do in that moment is to give them love, to give them some sort of light, to give them, as we are talking about in this entire season, hope. Emily very vividly, you know, has this discussion with Fraser and is like, you know, hope is all we have, right? Like, what if hope is all we have, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that, like, it's what we have to do. It's what we have to do. Like, when you are in a situation like that, when, I mean, we see it now, Emily, all she can do is just give light. It's just try to give light through her poems, through her words, through her interactions with people. I mean, through the letters she had written back and forth. That's all she can do.
Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, in a scene where everybody is essentially saying goodbye to Fraser, right? When they're doing the maple sugaring and everything. And he's looking for Emily, right? He's trying to find out where she's at. Throughout the episode, they break apart different stanzas of the same poem, which is, "It feels a shame to be alive." But one line kind of stands out for me, and it kind of speaks to what we were just talking about, you know, where she says, "Are we the weight sufficient worth?" Like, I think that speaks to, you know, kind of part of why I guess we feel guilty going forward when we see things like that. Like, they don't have what we have, but their circumstances may have been similar. So you try to relate, but a lot of times people just simply justify, like I did for so long, you know, like.
Well, I mean,
trying to placate yourself.
Yeah.
And I feel like in this moment with him, with Fraser, you know, when he actually reads the poem, which he doesn't until the end, right? Yeah. But in this scene is the first break apart, and it's not the first stanza of the poem. It's actually like the second, I believe, second or third stanza of the poem. But I feel like that one line just kind of, the first line of the first stanza and the first line of this one, I feel, tell the full story of what this poem is trying to say. And I feel like when she gives it to him and she says it's for nobody, I feel like that's him accepting that this isn't peddling some false hope. This is real, and real gives me hope.
And the crazy thing is like during their interaction, what really, like when Emily is like, "What if hope is all we have?" Like Fraser is just basically, you know, sometimes he says, "Sometimes the most hopeful thing we can do is look directly at the darkness." And I mean, that kind of brings me back to what we said about, you know, in episode one, is like, we go through all this pain, all this grief, all this, you know, all this suffering, but it brings out the best of us.
Yeah.
And sometimes we just have to look at it for what it is. We have to look at people's pain. We have to look at people's suffering. We have to look at people dying or our country falling apart for us to be better, for us to try and be better.
Yeah.
And do better for the future generations.
Yeah. I don't know if I ever shared this, but in my day job that I don't talk a lot about, which is an amazing company, the former president was talking to us, and we have these really amazing calls every month. It's kind of hard to talk about it without really talking about it, but anyway, on this one call, this was like at the beginning of the year, and he, you know, there's like 200 people on this call, and he was like, "Look, I just, you know, there's a lot going on right now, and I just want to say, we know how hard it is, but we all have to hold the darkness and the light at the same time for us to be able," you know, he's very politically active, and he's just this amazing human being, but it just always stuck with me. And that's the only way for us to be able to overcome things, is to be able to hold the darkness and the light, to be able to look at the darkness as well as seek out the light. It just reminded me what y'all were talking about.
I was really, and it makes a, oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it was also a nice callback to what Henry said in previous season, you know, in season two, when he makes a statement, "This country is going to have to destroy itself before it can heal."
Yeah.
You know, that kind of comes full circle into, I think, what we're talking about here.
Yeah. There was two things in this episode that really struck me. One of them was, and I thought about you both because you're both vets, is Fraser going to that party and then thanking Emily later and saying, "You're the only one who's being real about this," basically. And there were these moments with him where you could see him wanting to be with his, like being with his friends, but what's going on in the back of his mind, and the fact that he knows that there's a really good chance he will never see them all again. And he does like say something about it too, but some really good nuanced acting as well from that actor, which I thought he was, I always knew that he was really good from the last you know, from the first viewing of everything, but really like in the second rewatch, kind of watching his nuanced acting in there. So that was like on the heavier side. On the lighter side, there were a couple of lines that I think Abby had were the best, where she was like, George came in with some kind of fact and she was like, oh, look at you, George, with the facts. And like,
I just real quick, I just do want to highlight his the guy who played Fraser. His name is William Pullen.
Okay.
He's absolutely brilliant. He was recently in a film with Sandra Bullock. I think it's called Unforgiven. I think you can watch it on Netflix. Mm. He's absolutely brilliant. And I don't think they could have found a better Fraser Stearns, like, or someone to play nobody as good as he did. Like, he brought the darkness, the what we needed, the balance we needed, because there was a lot of comedy this season too. Yeah. But he brought a different balance to it all.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, the balance was nobody was the darkness and Fraser was the light, but Fraser accepted the darkness. He held both light and darkness, speaking to what you were saying, Robin, as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And he played nobody. He played that so well. I mean, and that was actually directed really well too, because it's a lot of different ways that they could have pulled that off. And he had this lost quality about him where, like, you knew before he even said it that he didn't really know who he was, but it wasn't overt. It wasn't like, I'm nobody, you know what I mean? Like, I can't, it's hard for me even to articulate it. And I think really good acting, like, I don't even want to, right? Because, and also I don't know what his technique was, but I just thought that he embodied it so well. He embodied both his kind of otherworldly connection to her through nobody and the actual character Fraser so well.
I will say the actor, William Pullen, the character he played in Unforgiven with Sandra Bullock is also a very, very dark character. So I just think he plays dark very well, but he also plays pain very well.
He's so vulnerable.
In a very beautiful way. Yeah, in a very beautiful way. So I enjoy his work thoroughly. And this, just the interaction between Emily and Fraser, for me, were some of the best interactions throughout the entire show.
Well, I mean, other than her poetry, he didn't want anything from her. He never did. And everybody she knows wants something from her or pulls something from her. I mean, that's just an observation, though.
Yeah, totally. You know, it's interesting because I'm looking at my notes right now and Fraser actually says, sometimes the most helpful thing you can do is to look at the darkness. Like, that's his actual line. And then it's the first mention of Dante in the Inferno. So there you go. There you go. There's that thread. So I think getting back to the comedy, I think we talked about the flawless nature of, like, when Sue was giving birth and between Haley and Ella was brilliant. Jane was just always just amazing. I mean, I just love how she snapped into, like, all right, let's go. And the minute Sue was about to give birth, Edward's like, what about me? And she's like, she just turns around and she's like, Edward, you're fine. Gets out of bed. And she's just in full mode. I also looked up what a pig scraper is. Do you guys know what that is? When she's like, she uses the shears and then she's like, oh, you know.
Yeah, we're going to need the pig scraper.
Do you know what that is?
No, I don't think so.
I looked it up. It also removes hair. So it, like, you use it usually when you're, when you've killed a hog or something and you're trying to get the hair off the skin, the hide. Mm. So she's going in there and doing some landscaping.
I can't. I can't even hold it together while you're telling this story.
Like, I love that whole scene. I love when Jane slaps her. I thought Ella was great. And that's some of the best comedic stuff she's done. Haley is always amazing at comedy. I just thought all of that. And then I think we talked about it. And then Maggie,
oh, she was so funny even before the birth scene.
What?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, she was funny, like, before the birth happened. Who? Talking about she wanted to ride in like Paul Revere.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, I think her comedy stuff was great. But I feel like sometimes, yeah, I just feel like those three and Maggie, actually, those four, yes, going through that whole pregnancy thing was just really, really beautiful watching it.
I don't know. Yeah, she made a lot of that scene for me. She made a lot of that scene for me. But what really stood out for me, I think, between Emily and Sue, really was when Sue tells her, "How is a baby? How is something so big supposed to come out of something so such a tiny hole?" And she looks. Right, that's what got it for me. Right, Emily just she looks at her like, I don't know, and she kind of like half-ass looks and questions.
I just want to say I love the fact that Mrs. Dickinson took one for the team and was like, I'm gonna help you birth this baby. Like,
oh, she was in her element. Forget about tea. She's like, this is just like we used to. I can still smell the stalls right now. Like, she's a
Norcross Family Farms over here.
She was bossing it, yeah.
But the mother-in-law was not about to let Sue not let her be there for the birth, baby. No, she was taking charge. She was like, no, I'm going to help you with the damn birth, okay?
Yeah.
And then I just love, that bitch won't let me hold the baby.
Well, giving birth is one thing. Having somebody take charge while you're giving birth, I would imagine, is one thing. But then, I mean, Sue says it later too. She's like, you know your mom. I mean, come on, Mrs. D, you know, she'll steal that baby and not give her, you know, not give him back, but
yeah. She would be a baby napper.
Oh, that was just flawless. All right.
Well, I mean, both of these episodes had a lot of comedy in both of them. Like, I really saw a lot of comedy as much as I saw darkness.
I love the balance. I love the balance because, like, there were some heavy things that we don't love to discuss, because obviously no one likes to discuss heavy things. But
I do.
There was such a nice balance.
The show is so good at that, and I feel like they reached kind of a perfection, Elena and her team, in season 3. Like, I feel like there's always been really great comedy and great, and I think it's always been really well balanced. But the more I'm watching season 3, the more I feel like that balance is completely organic. And like, as an audience member, like, you just, it's like somebody shifting gears in a car and you're like, okay. And it all makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. And I think it's because they're such fleshed out characters. It's such good writing.
I feel like the family unit that the team had as well had a lot to do with it. The connection that you have with your team surrounding you will always give you a better result or a better product.
Yeah. You mean the ensemble, the acting team?
Acting team, the writer's room, just the team as a whole, like everyone's connection to each other, the amount of care they put into this show. And I'm gonna be real with you guys, these first two episodes had me in tears. Like,
I was completely engrossed. I mean, I was even more kind of engrossed than I was the first time I saw it. Like, I feel like, you know, it's kind of different because I'm like really watching it. I'm not just waiting to see, again, like I've said a million times, what was gonna happen with Sue and Emily. But like,
and I feel like we've all been through a lot of life since the first time we've watched them. And I feel like now that has, like, I feel like we maybe have deeper connections to these episodes.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like I've said this before, like, I've been on sets, and so I was the first AD, and you run the set, right? That's kind of what you do. You run it for the producers, like, you're not running it for yourself. And like, your whole thing is that the set is running, and the whole crew becomes this big family, and you can have dysfunction, you can have all this, but somehow you have to find a way, and you got to keep moving, right? Because you hire people, and you don't hire crew with chemistry, you know. But Elena brings a lot of people with her, but you have to become like this moving unit, because you shoot 15, 16 hours a day, 6 days a week, and you're on the train and you're not getting off, right? So everybody's job, the AD's job especially, is to like, how's this going to work? How's this going to work? And how, you know, et cetera. When there's extra chemistry in there, when people really love what they're doing, it always shows. Always. And I haven't worked on a gazillion things, but not every show's alike, but like, when there's that extra passion and that extra, there's this, it's intangible. It's this intangible thing that, like, they used to say shows up on the celluloid, but nobody shoots on, well, this isn't shot on film, but So all that to say, Jay, I completely agree. Like, I think the ensemble and what they did together in season three, it's kind of their connection is palpable. Haley and Ella at a kind of a whole different level, which is really wonderful. And then Elena and her team, almost, you know, I don't know how much of her team was from the original season, but like Tim Orr, the DP was the same. The directors were all, like, with the exception of a few, were the same. Jennifer Muller, Marina Parker and her team, Dev, I forget Dev's name, but he was a production designer. Anyway, I'll just say that. You form a family, and when there's so much love and shared passion in there, it just, the end product just rises above the others, you know?
The one thing I will say, and I'ma get so much heat for this. It's okay. I'ma take it on the chin. It's okay.
Uh-oh, but truth. Listen. Is this a truth?
Yes. Uh-oh. Yeah, I said it earlier. Whoa. I said it earlier, okay? The CGI bird, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. Like, that is the one thing. That CGI bird had me on my knees in the middle of Target, okay? Like,
did you like see the CGI bird? Because Jay, it might not have been there. I don't. You know what? That might have been a thing. Maybe they made. I mean, they had money.
Yeah, everything. They had money. Like everything. Everything was purposeful, right? But I don't. That CGI bird will forever just be. Like, everything is great. I love this show so much. All three seasons were incredible, but that CGI bird will forever have me by the throat. These gay bones, man, and these gay bones just was not vibing with that CGI bird.
I bet it was intentional, or maybe not, because I mean, they did release it in the same year that they released season two, and so
yeah,
maybe they got stuck in post. You know,
fast turnaround. Yeah,
maybe they got a fast turnaround, or I don't know, Elena. Maybe I don't know. It's interesting. We'll never know, or we have to ask Jay.
Or maybe they just couldn't get real birds from that area
to stand still.
Who could do that?
Yeah, I think birds, like, I think trained birds have to be like a certain kind. I don't think you can train like a wren.
Yeah, like a hawk.
Like a hawk, or like, yeah.
Like an owl.
CGI is probably a lot easier to do. I don't know.
Yeah, much more cooperative, I would imagine.
I think so. I don't know. I mean, I don't train birds. I don't know, but I want.
Then again, you know, Emily's imagination just, you know.
Maybe that's so... That's what I'm saying. Maybe it was intentional that it's like larger than life or small. You know, it's small, but it's like, you know what I mean? It's like supernatural in nature, or imagine. I don't know. Who knows?
Not us.
We ready to wrap it?
Wrap it. Put a pretty little bow on it.
Put this baby to bed.
All right.
Just a quick little message. We want to say thank you for listening to us. And you can follow us on our podcast Twitter @4evermore, capital POD. And you can follow us on Instagram @dickinson.forevermore.podcast.
That's right. And you can hear this podcast on Spotify or wherever else that you listen to podcasts.
Rolling.
One of us has to do it.
I got this. No, I got it. I got this because I'm gonna pose a question.
Oh, great.
Okay. It is nothing crazy, all right? I actually want you to. I want you to feel. I don't want you to think.
How reactionary of you, Robin?
Wait, what? Jay, what? How dare you? Okay, go ahead.
Okay.